Good evening and welcome to the Y-Files. I'm your host, Susan DeCamp. Tonight we're going to be talking about Data Smog, which is a book written by David Shank, and it's about surviving the information glut. David Shank is a former fellow at the Freedom Forum Media Studies Center at Columbia University. He's also contributed articles to Harper's, Wired, The Washington Post, and The New Yorker. And he's been an occasional commentator for NPR's All Things Considered. Well, welcome to Montana.
Thank you.
From New York
City. It's really nice to be here. It's beautiful.
I guess the best way to start off would be to define what data smog is.
Data smog is, it's what it sounds like. It's the unintended, unwanted distractions, all the data, the information, the dreck that you don't want in your life, the spam email, the commercials that on TV and everywhere else that bother you and distract you. We're now living in this very paradoxical age where obviously we have all these wonderful new information tools, and it's wonderful to be able to communicate with anyone so speedily, but along with that comes all this information that we don't want. We have email, which is great, but we have 100 emails a day, which, you know, can bog us down, and people complain they never actually get through their email inboxes. So it's that other side of this speedy, efficient communication world.
And maybe you could run through some of the sources of besides email, of data smog, and where these things, some of the different components.
I try to take a fairly broad approach to it. I mean, the general idea is that we live in a really busy, distracted, dense informational world now, and if you want to plug into that world in any way, that is, if you want to, you know, watch TV, it's not just three channels, it's, you know, 150 channels. It's all the choices you have to make of what you're going to watch. You can get information sent to you, you know, by a fax or FedEx or letter or email, or, you know, now we have these wireless email devices. It's just at the end of the day, kind of, if you close your eyes and you look back at all the just the amazing amount of data that has come your way, some of which you had to ask for, some of which just kind of came your way without you wanting it, and you just having to face the stress of sort through that. That's what living in a data smog world is. I don't by any means say that we wouldn't want to live in this fast, exciting world where you can reach anyone at any time, but I do say that there are these side effects, these unintended consequences, these trade-offs of living in such a world.
I loved some of the statistics that you had in the book. For example, in 1971, the average American received 560 daily advertising messages. And in 1991, it was up to 3,000.
Yeah, I mean, and anyone who has cable TV, you know, I don't have to tell them these stats. I mean, they're living this stuff. It's just extraordinary. And I think, you know, what we all need to do is realize that this stuff has effects. I mean, this is a part of why we're more stressed out now. This is a part of why the rates of depression are higher in this culture, which we supposedly have everything we want and our standard of living supposedly so much higher than it used to be. But depression is rising. Why is that? We're connected, but we're also kind of paradoxically disconnected because there's so much to sort through. And in a way, the electronics are kind of pushing us farther apart from a warmth of human connection.
One thing I'd never known before that you described in the book, too, was the derivation of the word spam. I never knew that.
Spam comes from the great comedy troupe Monty Python. And there was a skit, I think fairly early on in their work, where they're sitting in a cafe and two or three fellows are sitting there, and the I believe waitress comes up and says, and they say, you know, what do you have today? And she says, well, we have spam, spam, and spam. And it turns out that all they have is spam. Oh, you can have spam on spam, 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 eggs, toast and spam, toasted spam with spam. And it becomes this joke on have nothing but spam. But some very clever pioneer of the internet kind of saw the connection there between that skit where all they would say is this word spam and what this person was seeing in his or her email box, which was just this endless kind of list of stuff that he hadn't asked for.
Well, let's talk about some of the negative side effects too. You talked about unintended consequences. What are some of those unintended consequences of all this information?
In my view, what's happening to us, it's not that we can't adjust to this pace of information. We adapt. I mean, humans are famous for adapting to different conditions. And obviously, in the last several thousand years, we've adapted to very different conditions over time. The problem is what happens when we adapt. So we become so good at screening things out that one of the things that happens is I make an analogy between kind of living in a high-stim, information-distracted world and being in Times Square in New York City. It's like when you first get there, it's overwhelming, it's intoxicating, it's fun, but you know, everyone who comes to New York, and I think Montana people will really empathize with this, they say, well, it's a fun place to visit for 48 hours, but I certainly wouldn't want to live there. Well, I do live there, and what happens is you get used to it. It's kind of sad, but true. You actually learn to screen out all this stuff, so you become harder to reach. We live in this world now where more and more people are trying to get our attention, and they're happy to get our attention for 2 microseconds. I mean, it's amazing if you look at these top screen messages and these top screen ads on the internet and these extremely fast radio and TV commercials. They realize that we're in this eyeball economy, and if they can grab your attention for a split second, it's worth something. And on the other side, the consumer is learning day by day to be able to screen this stuff out. Well, so the worst of all these conditions is that there's this spiral effect where the marketers are trying to reach us. They have to keep raising the volume level. They have to becoming more coarse and vulgar and do anything they can do to grab your attention. And we, as consumers, get better and better at not paying attention to that stuff. So we live in this world where Howard Stern is king, you know, where people just do vulgar things and they become celebrities for it. And that's what drives their celebrity and their success. And it's this paradox, particularly because we're living in a complex world. It's actually harder to figure out what the truth is about various policy issues or environmental issues or what have you. We actually are more in need of experts who will explain nuance to us. The people who should be in charge are people who can really kind of calmly go through the sift through the facts and, you know, these real policy wonk people. But in fact, we're giving our attention to the opposite, the people who make things real simple and crass and, you know, can just bring it down to a snappy line.
You think that has anything to do with, you know, the American affection for absolutes? You know, we have a tough time dealing with ambiguity. Is that making it worse?
Yeah, I think that this is probably a particular problem in America for that reason, is that we love the cowboy line, and we love the anything that just kind of sounds like it's standing up for something, and it's this top virtue. And that coincides with this thing of, you know, this vulgarization of culture where, and this simplification of messages where people will just kind of sum things up with this snappy line that just sounds, oh, that's, yes, that's right, that's, and they're hitting you in a gut level, but they're not really sorting through the complexity of an issue the way they should be in many cases.
And do you think it affects the way we treat each other?
I have to think so. I mean, I think that, you know, on a simpler level, what's going on is that we're all, you know, going from 500 advertising messages a day to 3,000, and going from 0 emails a day to 200, going from a place where you know, had your phone at home and you picked it up occasionally to answer it to where you've got a phone and it's ringing wherever you are. We become busier. We become less patient. Our kind of brains are turning faster. We don't have the patience for people that we used to. And I mean, I'm exaggerating this a little bit because it's possible for people to become perfectly calm in this environment. But I think on the whole, there's this new stress level that comes with being distracted.
You mentioned how we adapt to the overload, what we're doing right now and filtering and things like that. Where are the losses in this?
Well, one of the losses is in nuance. As I said, we learn to screen things out, and it's and we tend to pay attention to the simpler line. I mean, I know one experience I have is I get so much email now. I can think back to when I was, you know, 15 or 20, and getting a long letter in the mail was like the greatest thing that could happen to you. You'd sit down and you'd read the whole thing and you'd pore over it and read it several times and, you know, start to to put together a long response. I mean, that's one of the great things of being alive is having this, you know, nice, long, thorough, meaty correspondence. Well, now, even, you know, with my closest friends, we don't give each other time for that. I want them to send me two lines of something. Get to the point. Don't send me a three paragraph email. That's, you know, and when I hear myself saying that, I think, God, I've given something up, not just in my lifestyle, but in what I want out of life. I mean, after all, at the end of the day, at the end of the year, at the end of the lifetime, we look back on all this busyness. We want to have lived a meaningful life. We want to have made real connections with people and shared ideas and made a difference. And looking back on a million or a billion kind of interactions that are real quick and thrilling and fun and snappy, I don't think it's going to mean a whole lot to us when we're reflecting years from now.
I wonder if this is changing the way we think about tourism, too, and if there's anything that could be correlated to that. Instead of going to an urban center like New York for relaxation to kind of get in touch with the cultural offerings and things like this, we go to places where we can be alone with no phones, no TVs.
That's a great point. Yeah, I noticed I started hearing that when I was researching the book. I noticed that as I was talking to people about this, they would say, I think this kind of phenomenon hit people in big cities like New York, you know, before it hit people in smaller towns. So it was easier to kind of get the early feedback from people in big cities. And some city friends of mine would say, "Oh God, you know, I used to go to these exotic, fun, you know, rich places. Now I just a vacation for me is no information. A vacation for me is an island without a phone." You know, without a fax, that FedEx actually will not get it to you there overnight, and just sitting on a beach or whatever, sitting in a room. I noticed when my family and I went to Japan, the solace, the depth of the quiet of sitting in one of those, you know, stone rock gardens or one of those quiet temples where there's just absolutely nothing going on. I mean, it really grabs you because it's so different from what our normal lives are these days.
You made an interesting point about the evolution and how culture evolves rapidly, but human beings are pretty much the same as they were 35, 50,000 years ago. And some of the impacts, I would think even in our hearing, so many people go deaf because their ears are just worn out.
Well, this is one of the things that it's a great observation, a great question, but unfortunately, the answer is something I think is going to take us, you know, probably hundreds or thousands of years to figure out. I mean, I have ongoing debates with some of my technology colleagues. There are people who think that our brains are, you know, just adapting on the fly and that we're kind of mysteriously built for this time where even though we live 5,000 years without much information at all, we can now sort through, you know, 1,000 email messages a day, or who knows how fast it's going to get. I've got a friend who is really into this idea of kind of hyper-fast TV where, you know, we think MTV is fast now and all this kind of quick-cut TV. Well, you know, wait till 10 years from now where it's just coming by so fast it's like a blur and you're just kind of taking it in unconsciously. You're not even really, you know, following the storyline. You're just kind of in this hypnotic state. I have to think that, you know, we will adapt in whatever way because, and of course, on a certain level, we want this stuff or it's the market wouldn't give it to us. But I do think that, you know, we are not paying very close attention to what we were kind of built to do and the kind of stream, the pace of information we were built to take in. And I think that there's just got to be all sorts of unwanted side effects, physical, psychological, et cetera, from adapting to this just extraordinary pace of information.
Well, humans are, you know, particularly clever, too. And a lot of folks have really caught on to how to use this information age to generate their message and get things across. And I was interested in your research in think tanks, which really aren't that much about thinking at all.
Think tanks are about communication now. I mean, it's all about communication. It's about kind of quickly coming up with your message and getting out to people as quickly and as snappily as possible. I mean, it's amazing how, you know, it just used to be a handful of people who worried about the message and, you know, and how people would take this in on a retail level. And everything else was just kind of about real communication and, you know, sending these longer, in-depth memos and explaining issues. Well, now it's like everyone is their own press agent, because people realize you can get, anyone can be, you know, you can work for a think tank. You don't have to go through journalists anymore. You just issue press releases or start your own cable channel or send out emails to your email network. You're communicating with your audience. So people are much more savvy, as you say, about crafting these things for as they say, retail consumption, which is a danger. This idea that you can bypass journalists, even though journalists aren't terribly popular these days, you know, the good ones serve a really important function. They stand in between those message makers and us, and they help us make sense of all these wild claims that people are making for their own purpose and their own self-interest, and they help us filter that stuff. And without that filter, we're getting now all these emails and watching all these cable channels that are, and all these infomercials that are just kind of coming from the original sources. And it's really difficult for us because, you know, we don't have more time in the day to filter this, to figure this stuff out. We have less time. So we're just kind of seeing this stuff on the fly, and we don't want to take it at face value, but we also don't have a chance to hear the rebuttal or the informed, filtered response.
And it's tough because there's such a huge body of information out there that if you want to push a particular point of view, you can ignore this 95% body of information that says you're wrong, pick out the 5% that might agree with your point of view, and use that and crank it out there as fact.
It's so easy. I mean, statistics are, what's that line? Lies and statistics
damn
and damn lies.
And statistics.
Right. And that's, you know, more true than ever, because you can, as you say, you can find anything to prove your point, and which I suppose debunks anything that I've written in my book, since I used statistics. But it's you can find anything, any way to prove your point. You can find some study somewhere, and what you need to do, of course, if you're being really honest with yourself and with whatever audience you're trying to reach, is dig deeper than the first 5 or 10 statistics that prove your point. You need to look at all the evidence that you can find and take as much time as you can to weigh this stuff, and then present a real balanced read on whatever subject you're dealing with, and not just kind of take the skim off the stat that proves your first hunch, because that's not doing anyone any good at all.
Well, there's an important point in that too, is you mentioned things that people need to do in order to deal with it. It doesn't look like it's going to go away anytime soon. So people have to, we have to look at the way we construct our lives and how we handle information to be more discerning. I wonder if anything's going on in the public schools right now teaching kids to be more discerning about their information, that what you get on the net is not fact necessarily.
I think some of those messages are being taught. I mean, I think in a lot of our public schools, particularly a lot of our city public schools, I come from New York, and, you know, they're just struggling to get people, you know, to read and all those basic things. Unfortunately, our schools are, I think, breaking down for different reasons. But yeah, absolutely, we need to tell ourselves as adults, and tell our children that that there is this double edge to living in this connected world. We need to be all very skeptical about the information that's coming our way. We need to be skeptical about the uses of new tools that we might adopt. There's always a reason to adopt a new tool, but we're also always giving something up. We're changing our lifestyle in some way, and we might be giving up something that we didn't realize we would. I mean, buying a phone that's got all these gadgets on it might actually complexify our lives. It might complicate our lives more than we want. You know, so we got to memorize this, how all these things work. We're not using half the stuff, but just even the simple things are kind of hard to figure out. And before we know it, we don't have a phone. We've got this kind of mini computer, and it's got software, and, you know, but then just as we're figuring it out, it breaks, and we've got to trade it in for the next model up. So, I mean, the most important message here is not to, like, disconnect and get away from all this stuff, but as you're taking advantage of all these new tools, to realize the trade-offs, to ask yourself how it's affecting you in the broad sense, not just in the thrill of getting these messages wherever you are, but... and all the time, but are you having enough time to do the things you really want to do? Are you still, if you enjoy reading, are you still making time to read articles and books? If you enjoy personal contact, are you still giving yourself the time to have real conversations, or do you have call waiting, and are you letting the technology interrupt the life that you really want to have?
So we develop our homes as oases in the middle of all this information glut. I have another suggestion in there. I've requested that my children not be walking billboards and not wear clothes with corporate logos on them. And they were actually pretty open to that.
Yeah, that's, I remember while I was writing this book, and I was watching, one day I was watching golf tournament, and they were showing the golfers, and every picture of every golfer was actually just an ad for whatever they're wearing on their hat. It had nothing to do with, you know, who they were or where they came from. It was just like a picture and the logo, and boom, let's move on. They just got paid their $5,000. it's true. We're just saturated with advertising. It's absolutely everywhere. I suppose it's a lost cause to really try to, you know, not live in a world where we're being bombarded by ads. But, you know, as you say, you know, if you can make an effort not to become a part of the problem, or to carve out a space in your life where you're not, you know, where you have some freedom from the messages that are being targeted to you, I think that's important.
You had another concept that I found was very interesting, and that was cultural balkanization, another unintended consequence of all this information. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, this is one of the kind of second-order effects of information overload. We can adapt, but we have to specialize. But you can't take everything in that you're getting. So if you have to become a specialist in certain subject matter. So we see, I mean, the easiest example is to look at what's happened with medicine over the last 100 years. It used to be everyone was kind of this general doctor. Well, then we got more and more information about how to treat people, and doctors had to specialize, and now we have sub specialties. Well, that's going on in the larger culture as well. We are, you know, there aren't 3 TV channels anymore. There are, you know, 200. So you find the channel that fits your very narrow, specific cultural interests. If you like this certain sport or hobby, or you are this certain demographic, there are these shows that are being aimed at you. Same with magazines. There's a paradox here. It's a richer life in some way. You're actually living this very specialized, fun life, dealing in all this nuanced information of whatever hobbies or vocation that you have chosen for yourself, sharing, you know, this kind of specialized language with people who are interested in the same things. But at the same time, you're kind of not living a life with everyone else. We're kind of it's the end of this kind of general, kind of broad national or international culture where you might be able to share information with people who aren't exactly like you. And I don't say this to be nostalgic, because we wouldn't necessarily want to go back to this place where we're all watching the same channel all the time, but we need to realize that we do give something up when we don't share information with people who aren't exactly like us. It's harder to reach across the table or the hallway or whatever and have a shared understanding with people. I think the best way of explaining this is to repeat what Bill Bradley has said about race. He goes, and racial divisiveness is really important to him, and he gives speeches to audiences, and he says, "When was the last time you had a discussion about the subject of race with a person of a different race?" And then he says, if you can't say that you have recently, you're a part of the problem. If you're not reaching across these cultural boundaries and trying to make an effort to share your life with people who aren't exactly like you, then you're contributing to cultural and racial divisiveness, which we all recognize particularly now is this problem. We have to work to understand each other. And by living in these very narrow kind of niche media worlds, we're contributing to that.
And I think the most frightening thing that I find about the information technology and the information age is the loss of privacy and data mining and data valence, as you call it.
This is something that we're not going to be able to escape from, and it's odd because it's not exactly as though our privacy is being stolen, you know, away from us. It's more like we're kind of mindlessly giving it up. You know, when we sign onto all these websites and they ask for this information, that information, well, it seems kind of harmless to say what your favorite color is or where you live or what your age group is or income. But what's going on that you don't realize, as we all live these increasingly connected lives and all of our movements are kind of tracked electronically, is that they get added up and they start to form an extremely sophisticated picture of who we are. We're not too far away from where companies are going to know us better than ourselves in a certain sense. If you're buying, you know, 10 or 15 things online a day, or you're making information choices which are being tracked by these cookies, you know, these electronic cookies, they're learning things about you. They're learning how you're making these subtle, often unconscious choices about which lines appeal to you, which colors appeal to you, which sounds appeal to you, which eventually it'll be smells coming over the computer, believe it or not. And we make, you know, unconscious decisions all day long, and I think that we're all going to be increasingly uncomfortable with the sense that these messages are being tailored to us, not just using the criterion that we've said they can use, like, you know, I like rock music, or I, you know, like blue jeans, but the things that they're observing about ourselves that we don't even realize that in decisions we're making.
Well, even our governments have participated in some of that. Some states were selling the information from people's driver's license applications to data companies.
Yeah, although I think it's actually, I mean, I would tend to be more worried about what's going on in the private sector. I think that, you know, places like Amazon and everyone else involved in this, what a lot of these companies realize is that the profit margin on actually selling you something online is going to be very thin. But what may be worth more to them, in fact, are these profiles these very sophisticated consumer profiles of the people who are buying things, and they can then trade that information or sell it to other companies who can use it to then, you know, they have your email address or your home address, and they can then send an extremely sophisticated targeted mailing and not waste any money going to the people who they don't want to reach.
And, you know, I find this really offensive when it extends itself to our children, too, like the Educational Testing Service, the kids' SATs, ACT scores and things like that being used as part of a commercial data mining endeavor. I had to take a GRE recently, and which was difficult enough. But I was also subjected to a section of research without my permission. They forced me into this thing where I had to take this test in order to get out of the thing and finish my GRE. And that information was used by their company, and I wasn't even asked if I was willing to be a research subject.
Yeah, it's awful. It's absolutely awful. And what we see a lot of times is when you're filling out something, I hate to keep using these online examples, but the truth is that life is increasingly online. So you're filling out something just to get past this first page, just to find, you know, just to be able to buy the product. And what the real way to judge the kind of honor or virtue of the people who are putting up this site is, are they opting you in or opting you out? I mean, are they asking you to check a box to give them permission to use all this information, or are they saying, in order for us not to use the information, then you have to find this box wherever it is and check it? And obviously, the former is the honorable thing to do. They should make you opt in to a world where they can use your information, not just kind of assume that they can use it by default and make you go, you know, chasing them down saying, no, take me off your list.
Well, nobody's going to do that unless we sort of demand it on a public policy level.
I think a lot is going on. I mean, there are some really good people who work on this, and it's one of those hot button issues that people dedicate their lives to. So I think of all the subjects I get into in the book, this is the one that I'm personally least worried about, only because I know there's so many great people working on it. But it doesn't mean we should be blasé about it. We absolutely should. We should be mentioning it to the people who make policy. You're absolutely right.
And that concludes tonight's interview with David Schenk. He's the author of Data Smog, Surviving the Information Glut. David is a former fellow of the Freedom Forum Media Studies Center at Columbia University, and he's also contributed articles to Harper's, Wired, Salon, The New Republic, The Washington Post, and The New Yorker. And he's been an occasional commentator for NPR's All Things Considered. His new book is called The Forgetting, Alzheimer's, Portrait of an Epidemic. I want to thank you for joining us. This is Susan DeCamp.
Salutations and welcome to Christy the Wordsmith from Montana State University. Verbivores, have you ever wondered what caused the mortalities in the phrases dead as a doornail and dead ringer? We get a lot of mileage out of these expressions without understanding exactly what drives them. But if you can't imagine why a doornail or ringer is deader than any other inanimate object, don't despair. No one else has a firm grasp on these concepts either. Here are the best conjectures. The nail in dead as a doornail may have been a heavy stud against which a door knocker was struck. After many visitors had brutally percussed on the nail, it was said to have had the life knocked out of it, dead as a doornail. Appearing in 1350, the phrase is firmly established in our language. Both William Shakespeare and Charles Dickens employed this odd expression. The phrase dead ringer refers to an excellent imitation of something. The Henry Holt Encyclopedia of Word and Phrase Origins claims the term ringer was once slang for counterfeit, derived from the sale of brass rings for gold at country fairs. The dead of dead ringer doesn't mean the cessation of life. Just as the expression dead on means absolutely on target, a dead ringer is an absolutely convincing counterfeit or duplication. I'm Christy the Wordsmith. If you have a favorite word or expression, I'd like to know about it. Send your letters to me, Christy the Wordsmith, in care of radio station KGLT-FM, Montana State University, Bozeman, 59717.
Yellowstone Public Radio is KEMC Billings, KBMC Bozeman, KYPR Gillette, and KECC Miles City.